Good afternoon and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, one of the longtime leaders of the Inland Northwest arts community, Karen Mobley, pays a visit to talk about her latest creation, a book of poetry. Chris Massini introduces us to a regional singer-songwriter who took the plunge and entered NPR's countrywide Tiny Desk Concert competition. And Dan Webster offers his take on a new movie. A bit of ragtime piano from the Methow Valley's Bill Hotel takes us in. This is Northwest Arts Review. Karen Mobley is an artist, arts administrator, and art teacher well known to many, many people here in the Inland Northwest. Less known is that she is a poet, indeed a poet with a recently published collection of her work. We talked about her book, her writing history, and more.
I have always been kind of a closet poet and a writer of other things, essays, articles about artists and writers, those kinds of things. I did a chapbook in the 1990s, which was funded by the Wyoming Arts Council. With all the things that I have going on, I've always kept writing, and most of what I have been writing is fairly personal, and I would say that the book is actually very much a personal narrative. It talks about a variety of things that have happened in my life in sort of poetic form. It includes some stuff about my parents and my mother's long convalescence with ALS. There are some poems that are about my personal, I guess I'm going to call that faith and doubt journey, which people usually talk about faith journeys, but I think a faith journey is also a doubt journey. Some questioning about, I guess I'm going to call that sort of the big questions about the meaning of life. There's also some things that are humorous within the book. One of my favorite poems in the book is a poem that's called The Gimp Club. And it's a poem about a group of friends in Spokane that used to get together with John Jankowski when he was still alive, that he called the Gimp Club, and it was a group of people that would get together to drink. And we were all people with various, I guess I'm going to call them disabilities and calamities. John collected all the people together who had one hand and missing fingers and polio and various things, and he thought it was fun to get us together. And I wrote a poem called The Gimp Club that's about, I mean, it's not necessarily naming the individual people, but it's about the concept of this kind of odd group of people who get together. It's a fairly short book. Like a lot of poetry manuscripts, it's only about 48 pages of poems, and then it has kind of the normal stuff, right? A table of contents. And the cover is one of my paintings from the Skyish series, which I've been working on over the last few years. So if someone were to find the book, they might go, oh, that looks like one of Karen's paintings, because it is one of my paintings. Anyway, I've been doing a little bit of publishing over the years, mostly in things like, I was in Todd Marshall's Washington book that he did when he was poet laureate, and in Laura Reed's anthology, which was about Spokane. And I wrote a couple of poems about Spokane that were in that. I submit things to other places, you know, like probably a lot of people, like literary journals, also to local things. Like one of my poems, which is actually the namesake poem of the book, was published in the Inlander for the summer poetry issue that was edited by Tom Carraway. that was up on the Inlander website.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm probably better known as a painter than as a writer.
Right. And let me pursue that for just a second. I should mention that Karen Mobley's new book of poetry is called Trial by Ordeal. And you were mentioning about the book being relatively short, as probably most collections of poetry are. To me, that suggests, among other things, that poetry is just by its nature, for the most part, a much more concise kind of art form than biography or novel writing, or name the genre, that there's a kind of an enforced economy that's a part of that. Do you find that to be the case?
Well, yes. I would also say, I was talking with someone the other day about how it took me 10 years to put this book together, which it did. And they're like, well, it's only 48 pages long, right?
How long can that take, after all?
Well, so, I mean, if you think about it, it's really about 5 poems a year over a decade, right? I mean, I've certainly written more poems than that, but the other thing, it's both a forced economy because of the form. A lot of the poems in my book are what we would think of as pre-verse or, you know, things. I don't write a lot of sonnets and villanelles. They may have a structure, but it's not like a formal mm-hmm. structure normally. It's also picking things that make sense together. So, you know, you think about it, it's 48 pages of poems, and this group of poems has, I guess I'm going to call that, a narrative linkage between the poems and why they're together. There are some poems that I've written in the same period of time. Well, they're very nice poems, or at least I think they're nice poems. They maybe are about another subject. Some people know that I write these funny little, they're almost like little stand-up comedy pieces that are kind of erotica or humor pieces. Well, I don't have really any of that in this book, not because those aren't good poems, but they don't tie to the overall kind of arc of the, I guess I'm going to call it the story, although it really isn't a story. It's very episodic, talking about specific things and ways of thinking that belong to each other. That's a little bit hard for somebody to understand without reading it, but I think we would see that with a lot of writers, where there are bodies or collections of work that belong to each other that maybe, you know, maybe, I mean, I think about somebody like David Rombett, who's one of my favorite poets from Wyoming. I think he's done 5 or 6 books now. And while there is a kind of character to them, they also have distinct selection or curation of the poems for each book. Some of that's based on time period, but a lot of it's based on the thought process and the language and mm-hmm. how the poems hang together as a body of work.
You are, as you said, probably best known as a visual artist, and you have been pursuing that career, of course, for most of your adult life, and the writing has gone along with that. How do you think of those two modes of expression? Do they feed off of one another? Are they discrete aspects of your life? Or is there some sort of essential relationship in terms of the way you express yourself?
Well, I think one of the things that for most people reading my poetry, they would say that I use a lot of visual imagery. I find resonance in seeing a particular thing, and that evokes an emotion or an idea. And I think that because I rely very heavily on visual material as inspiration, both for painting and for writing, there's a sympathy between those things. Hmm. I would also say that my painting and drawing tends to be much more abstract than illustrative. So the poems have a very different kind of vocabulary than the paintings do. Although I think if someone were to go through like the last 20 years of my life, they might see that there are certain kinds of images that reappear. There are a lot of great blue herons in both my art and in my writing. There are a lot of landscape or plant or sky or geographic or geologic kinds of references. So I think there's a sympathy. I tend to work kind of in spurts on one or the other. So if I'm painting a lot, I may be journaling, but I'm not editing and doing what I call tidying up. I tend to really work hard on the art, and then probably like anything, I either get a little burned out or uninspired or sometimes even blocked, and then I switch over to writing more. And it kind of works back and forth. There are times, like when I was working on the book and I was working on all the editing and trying to figure out from the, when I started, I had over 100 poems and I was trying to figure out which ones belong together. So I spent, a good part of a half a year just reading and editing and looking at the ordering of how they would be together in the book. And I didn't do a lot of painting during that time because editing is a different thinking process than painting is. I would also say editing is a different thinking process than writing for me. I tend to go at both writing and painting in big bursts of kind of free expression and then kind of whittle it down. I don't know quite how to describe that, but it's a different way of thinking. I also think that I tend to paint more in my studio. I'm doing a lot of plein air painting and outdoor painting right now because the weather's been so nice, but I tend to do more painting in the winter because I'm less likely to be out roving around. And most people who know me know that I love to birdwatch and hike and go fishing and do those kinds of things. So in the warm weather, I spend a lot of time kind of gleaning ideas and photographing and taking notes and doing little sketches and stuff. So there's kind of a life cycle that also goes with the weather and the ability to kind of embrace nature. I think both my art and my writing also rely fairly heavily on a kind of vocabulary that comes from growing up in rural Wyoming. Mm-hmm. When you look at my art or my writing, I don't tend to have a lot of, I guess I'm going to call them urban images, or I don't know how to describe that. They tend to be more intimate, personal, and kind of microscopic rather than big, global. Very little of it is, political or big worldview stuff. It tends to be the intimacy that comes from taking a close walk on a short trail to mm-hmm. a body of water.
So no Edward Hopper images will be forthcoming from you at any time real soon.
I don't imagine so.
Right.
Although, it's not like I don't think about those things, but they're not in my work that much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there is a basic vocabulary that we all have, whether that's in terms of our words or in terms of visual images, that really have a lot to do with at the basis of where we are from. And as you said, the rural Wyoming just really informs your entire life as an artist.
It's an amazing thing to me that while I have lived away from Wyoming in my life as much as I've lived there, or maybe more now, that a lot of those things that come from growing up with a game warden dad and a mom who was a writer and a bird watcher and an acute observer of things, a lot of the things that interest me come from that childhood experience. And I think probably that's true for most people, that they learn to see and they learn to listen from their parents. And then if you're expressing things, oftentimes I think that our perspective on seeing and listening informs what we want to express to others.
Carrie Mobley's poetry collection, Trial by Ordeal, is available at area bookstores and from a variety of online sources. For more information, check her website, karenmobley.com. It's a tiny thing, but actually a big deal, as we learn from Chris Messini.
The Tiny Desk Concert has become a mainstay of the internet music world. Intimate concerts from well-known and obscure musicians performing at Bob Boylan's desk at NPR headquarters. And for the past several years, NPR has opened up the Tiny Desk Contest, asking musicians from around the country to submit videos performing at their own tiny desks. This year, one of those entrants was Jackson Roltgen from Coeur d'Alene, and he joins me now to talk about his submission. Jackson, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell me, how'd you hear about the Tiny Desk Concert, and why'd you decide to submit this year?
So I've been a fan of NPR's Tiny Desk stuff for quite a while. I've always been following closely on social media and kind of keeping up with the different things that they put out there, and always been really impressed with just the incredible talent that pops up, and a lot of the different artists that I look up to that have stopped by over the years. And so yeah, I saw just on social media that they were doing a contest, and yeah, I thought I'd just drop by one of my songs from my new album. So,
and was this your first time submitting to the contest?
It is, yeah.
So your song that you entered with is called Help. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about the song?
So Help is one of a couple songs off of my new album called Sentimental that I made last year, towards the end of last year. And one of a couple songs that I wrote for my friend, actually, who lost his father. We'd become friends while we were stationed together in Japan while in the Air Force. And yeah, he had lost his father and was kind of going through a difficult time. So a couple of the songs in the album are kind of dedicated to him, and that's one of them. It's also kind of a song that was written towards the start of kind of some turbulent times in our nation and in the world in general. And so I wanted to write a song that was kind of for the community, kind of for just sticking together and being there for each other, and a kind of a bluesy, soulful reminder to just to be there for one another and to give help to each other, because we need that fundamentally as human beings. So that's probably the song that encapsulates that idea the most on the album. But yeah, that's what it's about.
Well, to help our listeners get sort of a sense of it, let's play a little snip of that song. This is Help by Jackson Roltgen.
One, two, three. Sometimes life don't feel like you thought it would. But every new day is harder than the last. And you trade most anything for just a little strength to carry on. It can be hard to think the storm is ever gonna pass. And now what it's like to lose your home. Treat it like a secret just to save your pride. But I'm telling you now that it'll only break you down. Think you gotta keep it all locked inside. Everybody needs someone to turn to. So if you need a helping hand, brother, you know that I'll always be your man, brother. Cause sometimes even the strongest of us.
That was Jackson Roltgen and his song Help, his submission to this year's NPR Tiny Desk Contest. You mentioned that this song is about sort of helping each other in the community, and the lyrics really refer to, you know, helping people through rough times, which it feels like a very appropriate song for everything that we're living through right now. Do you feel it is especially relevant right now?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's always kind of this stigma. At least sometimes there's a stigma, I think, with asking for help and feeling vulnerable to need other people, whether that's just in conversation and talking about the way you feel or what's going on in your life currently, or more practical needs. But I think I think that's one of the things that we're built to do as human beings, is help each other out, understand each other, study each other, and be a friend. So that's one of the most beautiful aspects of being a person. So yeah, you know, between the coronavirus things and the racial divide that has been happening in our country for such a long time, and has kind of come to the front scene again lately. I think being an understanding person, being a listening person, and being a person that's willing to help other people is probably more important than ever. So,
yeah, that's well said. And speaking of help, you have some backup guitar and vocals in the video. Who's playing with you here?
Yeah, so a couple of my friends there are in the video. I recorded this song a while ago, and they learned it pretty quick for this video, so I was really appreciative of that. Yeah, it's my friend Drew Brereton on guitar there, and then Kara Werner, who is the wife of my drummer, Jack Werner, and she has a fantastic voice. So yeah, those are the people that are featured in the video. They're very talented musicians, and I'm very fortunate to know them.
So, you know, obviously this has been a strange time being sort of isolated from people, but I think especially for musicians and performers who are used to sort of going out and communing with audiences, have you been able to continue making music and finding ways to connect with folks?
Yeah, I have. I mean, it's been particularly strange for me because, like I said, this album is my sentimental, is my first album, and I just started making that towards the end of last year. Put it out towards the beginning of this year. So with the idea of kind of starting to build some momentum this summer, and then with things kind of being on hold more or less with the coronavirus. So it's been a little bit of a challenge for sure to get out there and get playing, but I've been able to do that a little bit. And then putting out some content online and stuff, this album, of course, being one of those things on Spotify and Apple Music. But yeah, I mean, it has been challenging. It has presented its share of challenges for sure. But yeah, I think as time goes on, you know, we'll be able to see ways to kind of overcome some of those things.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jackson Roltgen, his submission to this year's NPR Tiny Desk Contest is called Help. You can find the Tiny Desk videos and submissions from all around the country, including here in the Inland Northwest, on the NPR Music page, and we'll have a link to it from SpokanePublicRadio.org. Jackson, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate it.
The film Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always is a poignant study of real life, says Dan Webster in his review.
The struggle over abortion is one of the many issues that has split the United States into the polarized mess it's become. And there's no easy way to resolve the problem, what with one side claiming that abortion is about a woman's right to choose what to do with her body, and the other side defining it as the literal murder of babies. Even the wise King Solomon would have trouble mediating that dispute. Filmmaker Eliza Hittman likely has an opinion about which position holds the high moral ground. But in her film Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which she both wrote and directed, Hittman is less interested in campaigning for her point of view than she is in capturing the experience of a young woman who struggles to deal with the issue on a personal level. Autumn, played by newcomer Sidney Flanagan, is a 17-year-old high school student living in rural Pennsylvania. When we first meet her, she's participating in a typical high school pageant, the kind with Elvis impersonators and pop dance routines, playing an acoustic guitar and singing a song about the demands of love titled He's Got the Power. If that isn't enough of a clue as to what has happened to Autumn, then the glass of water that she throws in the face of a smirking teen boy is, followed by a predictable failed pregnancy test. The use of that word predictable, though, is the only time I'll use it in this review, because besides being the most accomplished film I've seen this year, Never Rarely, Sometimes Always doesn't go where anyone trained by Hollywood or TV melodrama would expect. The surprise that Hitman provides us is that there is no surprise, no big dramatic moment, just a series of naturally occurring yet continually intense sequences. That splashed water incident, for example, never leads anywhere in particular. It simply makes the point that Autumn, though as naive about life as any 17-year-old, is no pushover, and that failed pregnancy test is what sets her on her determined course to obtain an abortion. Yet she finds the process in Pennsylvania too difficult to navigate without a parent's permission, and for reasons we can only guess at, Autumn doesn't want to tell her parents anything. So, mustering their resources, she and her cousin Skylar, played by another fresh face, Tally Ryder, board a bus for New York, where the process promises to be easier. They lug with them a heavy suitcase that seems an improbable accessory, except as a visual metaphor for the emotional baggage weighing on both girls. And much of that baggage comes courtesy of the men in their lives, from Autumn's man-child stepfather to her careless fellow schoolmates, from her creepy store manager to the guy on the bus who hits on Skylar, but most especially the guy whom they see fondling himself on the subway. But some of it, too, comes in the form of a bureaucracy that seems designed to thwart Autumn's every effort to do what she wants. That includes both the staff members of the hometown clinic who lie to her about how far along her pregnancy is, and those at the clinic in New York who, by necessity, force Autumn to spend two nights in the city, time she can't easily waste waiting to have the procedure. It's in New York where Autumn is put through the interview that provides Hitman with her film's title. She is asked a series of questions, to which she has to choose as an answer one of the following: never, rarely, sometimes, always. And when asked whether anyone has ever forced her to have sex, Autumn, who for much of the film guards her emotions as if they were precious jewels, finally breaks, tears pushing from actress Flanagan's eyes as she struggles even to mumble her replies. That moment makes the question that her cousin had previously asked her all that more apt, not to mention profound. "Don't you ever just wish you were a dude?" Skylar asks. "All the time," Autumn answers. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. Movies 101 airs at 6:30 Friday evenings on KPBX and Saturday afternoons at 1 on KSFC. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm host and producer Jim Tevenin. We had help today from Chris Massini. My thanks as well to Karen Mobley, Jackson Roltgen, and Dan Webster. Another tune from Metal Valley ragtime pianist Bill Hotel takes us out. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.